I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next conversation is with Wayne Wapemukwa. He's a filmmaker who is premiering his new film, Luck Lucky, at the Toronto International Film Festival. And I believe the first showing is going to be on September the 12th at the TIFF Lightbox. You might want to look into that. This is a remarkable, compelling film that has deep and profound philosophical implications that will I believe, meet you where you are. I was profoundly moved by this on a variety of levels. And it's a film about so many things. Like any great film, it has a variety of layers. And Wayne and I had a great time. I hope he feels the same way. But it was one of those conversations, one of those interviews that I just don't want them to end. There's, we talked about, pretty much everything, from nihilism to psychoanalysis. We got into why love matters. What is it about community that is kind of a central starting point? We talked about glib patriotism. How interesting is that? And we made sure to clarify that Wayne is not anti-hockey. You might want to know that going in. But do listen in. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. And more importantly, I think you need to get out and see this film without a doubt. And why we all need to check our love from time to time. Wayne Wapemukwa coming right up, and his new film, Lucky. Don't forget facetofacelive.ca for more interviews there. And there's going to be quite a few coming up at the festival this year. And rabble.ca as well for other interviews too, dealing with a whole lot of issues. Wait for it. Wayne Wapemukwa coming your way. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by another very special guest today, and we're at a really favorite time of year for me. TIFF is about to roll in a couple of weeks, and we have a director with us today. Wayne Wapemukwa is with us today to talk about his new film. Wayne, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. I've been looking forward to this all week, and I'm happy to be here.
So, Lucky. Tell us about the film. It's not spelled the way it sounds. It's Luck-I, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct. There are a couple different variations on the spelling that I found, but that is the one that's the most prevalent. The name itself is the indigenous name for the area known today as the Downtown East Side. So Canada might have about 150 years of history, but this area has thousands of years of meaning and cultural significance for a multiplicity of different nations. And so with the movie, what I'm attempting to do is to unearth some of the deeper repressions that our country has founded upon that land. And the movie itself, though, is about five Vancouverites living on the fringes of society during the 2010 Winter Olympics.
Why set the story against the backdrop of the Winter Olympics?
Well, that's actually, I mean, yeah, that's interesting because it was a weird decision. That was actually perhaps the most important decision I made before finishing the script. There was a time when I was thinking about not doing that and just having it like a day in the life kind of thing.
Right, a movie about five people living in the downtown East Side.
Yeah, like over a day, you know?
Oh,
that,
I see.
That was
okay.
That.
Yeah. Right.
But I think the decision to commit to 2010 was, I was led to there for a number of factors, one of them being the simple contrast between, you know, the life on the streets versus the life on the rink. The contrast between Canada's poorest postal code, the downtown East Side, and the world's most livable city during the glib patriotism of the games. So, you know, yeah, in an important way, I guess, like the setting of 2010 was meant to bring out these larger political issues. But at the same time, I think that it reflects the form of the movie as being split, very much split from within, fact, fiction, real, fake, fantasy, reality. 2010, 2017.
Tell me a little bit more about that glib patriotism. So connect it to hockey. Is it hockey? Is it that Canadian sort of, I don't know, disinterest in what's really going on? Is that kind of what you're talking about?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, the movie itself is definitely not anti-hockey, and I personally am not anti-hockey either. I think that would be a somewhat banal position to take on the matter. The reason why I elect the phrase glib patriotism is because I'm interested in the way in which different things, such as sports and specifically hockey, for example, can be deployed by the settler state in order to advance the interests of colonization and theft of land, which we could also call renoviction today or gentrification. So that's, I think, the thing that I'm interested in with the patriotism is what is it that allows the settler state to not only continue colonization, but continue colonization in insidious ways that come off as patriotic or as pleasurable, I guess. And so the patriotism involved in spectating hockey, I guess, is one of the things I'm interested in about that mechanism of what makes colonization, what enhances colonization and what allows it to perpetuate.
So when you say, so colonization in a way has, I suppose some would argue, a historian would probably argue it's ended, right? It ended, and of course it all comes down to definition, it seems to me. And so you're talking more though about the ideological impact of it, the more insidious nature of it, that the stuff that you can't kind of see.
Certainly. I mean, there's a number of problems with the question, I think. I would hope that no historian would ever say that colonization has ended, first of all.
Yeah.
If I ever met a historian who told me to my face that colonization is over, I would punch them in the face. Because that
we
is
have it now on tape, folks. We now
there
have
we
it
go.
On tape. Yeah.
It is a categorically false statement. If anything, what's happened is that colonization has changed in very insidious and, I guess, macabre ways. Like, we could talk about what does colonization mean in the downtown East Side now that all the land has been stolen. But that's also another question because the land never was technically ceded, right? So,
right.
And there are many parts of the country, there are many parts of the world where there actively is land being stolen at this very moment. I think we saw one of the paragons of this may have perhaps been Standing Rock, where you know, with the advent of a pipeline, that is an item that is advancing the theft of land and the theft of resources in a very physical way. But to say that colonization is over because land has been stolen is false, because land hasn't been stolen and it is continuing to happen at this very moment.
Does it end through recognition, Wayne? Is that kind of what you're
certainly
hoping?
Not? Oh. No, that is also a very, very problematic solution. So I guess if we can get down to like some of the more theoretical inspirations for the movie, I think there's a number of inspirations I've taken from different arts, but I think that one of the most important philosophical frames of reference would be Glenn Cotard's work, specifically Red Skin, White Masks, which came out in 2014.
Okay.
And in that text, Glenn makes a very compelling and persuasive and true argument that recognition politics specifically, as they are expounded by Charles Taylor, you know, in the early 90s, I think, is actually just another way that colonization has perpetuated itself. So why is it that the settler state is in a position to recognize other sovereign indigenous nations, right? That in itself, the setting up that problematic is the problem itself, because the settler state technically isn't in a position of sovereignty over indigenous nations. So what does recognition mean in that context, I suppose? So that's also something that I've tried to play with artistically in the movie as well, the idea of misrecognition. And that comes from my more psychoanalytic background. Glenn doesn't get into this in his book, but sorry, Glenn.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say reflection really seems to play a role in Angel's character, right? And others too, but there's just the way you introduce. I mean, I got to say, oh, by the way, congratulations. I felt on one level so pulled in. I mean, it's a tragically beautiful film, and I felt I almost felt like I shouldn't be watching. You know, the way that you introduce the characters, the way you let me into their lives, the performances are just so. Is it fair to say that kind of raw performances, but. A deeply comedic edge to it, and just full of life, you know, and so anyway, congrats. And coming up, by the way, let's put in a little plug, September 12th, world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. And to get really specific, at 7:15 PM at the TIFF Lightbox. So yeah, congrats on a really compelling film. The mirror, the image, the reflection, that plays largely into Angel's character, but probably in others as well.
Yeah, so I guess the key word here is fantasy.
Okay.
So when I read Glenn's work on recognition and misrecognition, immediately alarm bells start going off for me because of all of the Lacan that I've read. I'm a very avid psychoanalytic reader.
Okay.
And the idea of misrecognition is a very important idea because it's basically the foundation to one's identity, is that we all kind of are walking around thinking of ourselves as an orthopedic whole.
Mm-hmm.
We see ourselves in the mirror, but, you know, when you get down to it, we're actually just a bricolage of different drives. And so what I tried to do in the movie to convey that more esoteric idea, I guess, was to have fantasies, to film the fantasies of the non-actors that were brave enough to share their stories, not only with me, but with the world.
Sure.
And what happens then? Like, do they lose themselves in these fantasies, or do they find themselves? And ultimately, the larger question at hand is, what happens to Canada as a state during the Olympics, which is itself a very important fantasy? Does Canada lose itself? Can Canada see itself? And what is revealed within the fantasy of the 2010 Winter Olympics?
You know, it's a film to me. I mean, the story itself is just so deeply philosophical. It's about trauma. It's about relationship. It's about the other. It's about, you know, our existential response to those that live around us, or lack of response. I suppose. I mean, it just this to me, one of the signs of any great film is the layers. And there's so many layers here. When you stepped into this story, what was kind of the launching point for you? What was the catalyst? I mean, obviously, some of the philosophy you've been reading, some of the psychoanalytic work with Lacan and so on. Was it a person? Was it somebody you were introduced to that, and you went, wow, this is the beginning. I see it now.
Yeah, I mean, there was no, like, singular epiphany, I guess. But I think that the foundational moment, if I can say that, was just meeting Angel.
Hmm.
I met Angel, I think, in, like, 2013, when I had just coming off of my last short film, which was at TIFF, and I was ready to make another movie. And I was doing research on the Downtown East Side, and Angel was kind enough to meet up with me a few times. And we eventually started to talk about doing a movie. And, you know, I was kind of going back and forth. I was humming and hawing about who to cast as, like, the main actress who was going to play a sex worker. And then Angel just straight up told me, she's just like, you know what, Wayne, I want to do it. Like, you know, sex work and acting, there's not really not that much of a difference. So I said, okay. You know, I took the plunge. I trusted Angel. She trusted me. And from then on, I think I was sold. I was absolutely sold on the idea of telling real stories with real people.
And is every, well, I was going to, is everyone, I was going to say, is everyone a real actor? That's a weird question based on some of the conversation we've already had. But, yeah, what would you call these folks actors?
Absolutely, I would. Yeah. Okay. I mean, the industry at large would refuse to, but as far as I'm concerned, every single person in this movie is excessively talented. And that talent comes from bravery. And it comes from courage, and it comes from trust, and it comes from time, and it comes from love, and it comes from our relationships that we've been building over the past few years and months at times. And so to call them all actors is also a complicated question, however, because so Angel is somebody who wants to be an actress. Jodie on Buffalo, who you might remember actually from Hello Destroyer.
From Hello Destroyer, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's also an actor that wants to act, but this was only his second credit at the time, I think, second or third. Same with Ken, maybe second or third credit. Eric is somebody who only ever acts with me, and he's been in a couple of my short films. And Miss Roller Girl, this is her breakout performance. So in terms of experience acting, I think the majority of the cast just work with me mostly.
Right.
And even though they want to, you know, platform into other projects in the future, yeah.
How would you define? And by the way, I know you mentioned before the tape was rolling that you've just finished your MA in philosophy, and that also another congratulations. Why aren't you teaching and writing philosophy rather than making films?
Well, what's the difference?
Nice. Probably not a lot of difference.
That's what I say. I mean, yeah, I've only ever made movies and read philosophy at the same time. My grandmother introduced me to two of the most important things that I've ever known in my life. One was nihilism and the other was socialism. And so even as a young kid, I was reading, unfortunately, I was reading a lot of Sartre and Nietzsche, and had an exceptional film program in my normal public high school that was, you know, in farm country Langley. So to be honest, I've only ever made movies and done philosophy at the same time. So I just keep on doing it.
Well, and isn't it really about a dialogue, a conversation?
Yeah, indeed, absolutely. I mean, ultimately, I think the kinds of questions that philosophy is interested in are very much indeed the same questions that cinema may perhaps be interested in. So, you know, again, there's a parallax I find between the two.
So how much of this film is about community and about finding healing through community?
Well, I mean, in an important respect, that's all the movie is about, ultimately, right? Communities are held together by stories. They're not held together by tragedies. And that was an important perspective that I wanted to adopt when making a movie about the Downtown East Side, because this is an area that has been colonized in more than one way. It's been colonized artistically and aesthetically. And so for me, one of the, perhaps the most important decisions I made on the movie were before it even started. How am I to approach this community? Am I an outsider? How can I deal with that? How do I check my prejudice? How do I check my privilege? One of the things that I thought was going to be the most important was community building and being involved in the community in as much of a capacity as I possibly could, because I knew it was going to be a movie about a community and specifically how this particular community can rise above some of the challenges and violences that it's been facing for some people, for decades, for others, millennia.
So, for Wayne, is this a movie about? This is going to sound kind of trite, I think, but work with me here a little bit. It's kind of riffing off. I think it's Ken's character near the end of the film, and for me, I think that was for me anyway. I don't know about others. That was kind of okay. It's making another kind of sense now when he says, you know. I think he's starting to get a little more honest with another character in the film. We'll have been scared together, he says, and it's a scary, scary place, this universe. Is that kind of a sort of a subtext for you as well, maybe as a philosopher, but as a filmmaker, and as these, you know, as all of these folks just, you know, their stories are intertwined, they're living together, they're working through it together, much like all of us in our own ways.
Is that kind of
where you were heading with this? I guess the question is that the starting point?
I mean it's an interesting, it's a very complex question. But that's what we deal with, isn't it? That's, so
well, and great filmmakers, right?
Well, one can only hope. So, yeah, I think anxiety is not a starting point, but I think perhaps like the prism, the emotional prism that I wanted to use specifically for Ken. I'm not entirely sure that anxiety factors as importantly in the other stories, perhaps with Eric a little bit. There's one sequence in particular where Eric meets his son at the hockey game. Here we go. This is good. So, like, that's his actual son, first of all. Justin. And I met Justin in 2015 when I was doing a documentary with Eric. And Eric asked me to track down his son. So I did. And there's one other scene in the movie where Eric is writing a Facebook message to his son. And he's writing the message with Joe. That was me. So I was in Joe's spot in that room, which is Eric's room, writing that message for him. And eventually I tracked Justin down, and, you know, Justin's got to be the kindest, coolest person that I've met in my life. We met up, we had a talk about the situation, and I was very upfront about the fact that I didn't want to come across as somebody who's like, you know, from the Make-A-Wish Foundation or anything. I'm here because Eric's a friend of mine and he asked me to reach out to you. So that's where I'm at. Would you want to talk to him or something like that? But other than that, that's not my job, is to build family. But when I was actually having that interaction with Justin, I was myself having a lot of anxiety because it reminded me of a lot of things that I've gone through in my life. And it was a very anxiety-provoking experience for me personally, because I was like sitting across from somebody who was relatively the same age as me, saying things that I have heard come out of my own mouth about their family. So that was the emotional window for me at that moment, was the way in which anxiety can serve as a medium for something more truthful, I guess.
Well, and isn't that the point, that the hope of the existentialist, that it gets you to a little bit more of an authentic place where, and now it seems to me we're back to community. Right, we're back to others. We're back to relationships. We're back to being honest and transparent with one another. And this is what I think is so beautiful about the film. Watching that scene, Wayne, with Eric and Justin, was I'm a relatively new dad. I've got a 12-year-old son and a 9-year-old daughter. It was hard to watch, and I think part of it was not only their interaction, but I think kind of the way you filmed it, and you know, the almost choppy cross-cutting, is that a fair way to say it?
To be technical about it, that was probably, I think that was the last sequence that I edited in the movie, and that was probably mostly for personal reasons. And there's a lot of resonances again with my personal life, but one thing that I went through, a couple different versions of it, and one of them was linear, like you know they meet up, they talk, he leaves, that's the end of it.
Right.
But it didn't quite work for me. And so what I ended up doing was cutting it to his emotional reality. It's like, because Eric isn't experiencing that moment like in a linear fashion. He's not experiencing it like, you know, A to B to C to D. happy, he's experiencing like AF1-3*4. So what I tried to do was cut it according to his emotional and psychical reality. And I thought that that would maybe, I guess you tell me, but I thought that it would kind of bring the audience closer actually to where he's coming from, because I wanted to avoid constructing a scene where we thought of him as an asshole. I wanted to construct a scene where we were to be able to go in his shoes and empathize with him in an important way.
Well,
that would be anxiety provoking.
It's exactly how it, well, that's how it played out for me. I mean, I mean, I think empathy is interesting that you bring that up. I think if I had an emotion after watching your film, it is empathy. It's I feel affirmed as a human being, as a dad, as a husband, as a friend, and now I want to take it to the next level. Like that was the. I would say my overarching reaction, but yeah, in that particular scene, definitely drew me in, and in a really compelling and engaging way. And like I say, it was, and I think that's what made it hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
How would I have reacted? How would I have responded to that as a son and or you know as a father?
Yeah.
You know, would you call yourself an experimental filmmaker?
No, but Telefilm would. I've been called.
Funny.
Apparently, I'm an untraditional house filmmaker, and I mean, okay, so
is that a good thing?
I don't care. I don't mean that in a pejorative way. To me, like it's the whole question is so senseless from the get go, but the terms are senseless, and I have the same response that Werner Herzog had when I was like. I must have been like 12 or 13, and I was watching Q on the CBC. I think it was televised in those days.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but Werner was on in an interview, and he was asked by the host if he is an avant-garde filmmaker. And do you know what his response was?
I don't actually. I wish I did.
Right? It was, no, I am not an experimental avant-garde filmmaker. I am the absolute center of the universe. And that's the kind of position that I take is, to me, the experimental weird filmmakers are people like James Cameron that make, like, obnoxiously normal, simple-minded movies. Like, to me, that's absurd cinema. That is crazy. I'm just here to, you know, help convey a story about five people that have been brave enough to share their stories with me. And I'm trying to do it in the most truthful and honest way I can.
Yeah.
And that's why the movie comes across the way it does.
No, it makes a ton of sense, and therefore it's not experimental at all. It's interesting. We're back to the word real again, or maybe authentic's better. It's more.
Sure,
it's
but
more,
I mean that's also a question, right? Like, I mean, what does that mean? Like, if this is a documentary, well, you know.
Well, and that's another question too.
Right. Exactly.
I have for you is it a doc? Is it a narrative film? It seems like this. Beautiful blend. I hate the polarization and the, you know, the implied in the question, but it's certainly a beautiful blend of various ways of telling a story.
Yeah, well, I mean, for as far as like, you know, our financial documents and grants go, it's a narrative because people don't understand me when I start talking about documentary, but as far as I'm concerned, it's a documentary through and through. It just happens to be a documentary which documents not only the quote-unquote real life, but also the psychical life, right? So what I'm documenting is the fantasies of the individuals in the movie, and these are real fantasies that they've told me. So, we, you know, one great example is there's a UFO in the movie, right? So somebody's like, to me, they're like, well, how can it be a documentary if there's a UFO?
Right.
And then my response is, you know, very, very, very cool handedly that, well, of course it's a documentary because Mark, the character who Joe is playing, who was a real person, who unfortunately passed away before he went to camera, he saw UFOs. And I remember being with him. I remember hanging out with him, giving him a ride home. And he would, you know, look out the window and say that there's a UFO. Now, I don't believe in UFOs necessarily, but it's not my job to pass judgment on what he thinks is real. So that's why it's a documentary, is because I'm documenting the real fantasies of of people.
So Lacan said the truth is structured like a fiction. It's quoted on your website for the film, which is luckyfilm.com, for those of you who are interested, luki film.com. What does that mean, Wayne?
Well, it means that reality is framed by fantasy. So what that means is that, if you take, for example, a dream. So you're dreaming and, some sort of traumatic or scary thing happens in the dream and you wake up. It's important to note the fact that you wake up the moment that something becomes more real than reality itself in the dream. Something touches you in an obtruse and anxiety-provoking way, which you wake up into. So reality is importantly the escape from something that's more real than itself. Reality is framed by fantasy. It's framed by, and you can understand that in terms of ideology. You can understand it in terms of, settler identification, what have you. The fact that remains that our reality does not make sense without some sort of fantasy frame that provides a consistency. So when Lacan says that truth is structured like a fiction, what he means is that in order to access the truth, we must pass first through fiction. Mm. Fiction must overlap itself in order to actually become more real.
Is it have anything to do with that? Is it the Disneyland like fiction?
That is a good question.
Hyper real.
Are those fantasies? Right. I'm not entirely sure that those are fantasies in the way that I'm talking about it, because, and this is the important distinction, I believe. What I'm documenting are the parts when fantasy breaks down.
Mm.
The parts when the fantasy starts to fracture and you can see the cracks and you can kind of just make your way through them. And that's the truth that I'm trying to get to. In Disney Right. World, that never breaks down, and they make it guarantee that it never breaks
Right.
down.
Right.
So to get back to the movie here, the important point, I guess, to relate it is that what I'm interested in is the way in which the Winter Olympics in 2010, as a giant social fantasy, broke down. What were the cracks of that fantasy, and what can we make of the truth behind these cracks? And that's precisely why I've tried to structure the film itself as a fantasy.
So at the beginning of the film, I think your establishing shot is a Canadian flag? It's colors, it's out of focus, it sounds like we've got, I think, hockey music in the background, national anthem, Olympics-like sound yeah. going on. Is that...
We're under the ice, man.
Okay.
We're under the ice. There it is. It's the logo, the 2010 logo, I think, is
beautiful.
Like obscured by the frame, and we're on the other side of the games, and that's kind of our metaphorical jumping
nice.
Off point for the movie.
And is that, yeah. but is that the best we can ever hope for, that out of focus?
But I guess that's kind of the point too, is like, in order to see the truth, I guess one must kind of take a step or two
yeah.
to the left or to the right. It's kind of an anamorphosis, a change in perspective, a parallax.
Well, it's and that's what, again, I mean, I found so great, beautiful about the film is the step, like I said, I think earlier, I felt voyeuristic in a way, stepping into these folks' lives. I felt like, wow, I need to have met these people first, said hello, shake their hands, had a coffee with them before all these stories could be revealed to me. You know, this is so intimate. It's a haunting piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you ever make your way to Vancouver, you'll probably run into Miss Roller Girl. She's
is that right,
up and down Main and Broadway, Canby Street. That's her stomping grounds. She's out there right now. She's got some hot pink Roller Girl Safety First tank tops that we provided with her, so she can try to sell them and get some cash. And you know what? There's that GoPro scene in the movie where she gets harassed by
yes,
hockey fans.
Yes. 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 Yeah.
Again. All real, all directly from her life. But if you ever want to come to Vancouver, you'll probably run into Roller Girl. She's definitely a local celebrity and icon.
So is it okay for me to say that one of my favorite lines in the movie is that there's more to being a celebrity than just looking like one? I had a few laugh out loud moments, and that is without a doubt one. Can I say intensely original too? Is that okay? I mean, it's just, yeah. So... marvelous on so many levels. So Patria is on your site, maybe we can kind of wrap this up because I think it's such an, and there's so many things, so many different ways we could take this conversation. We could wrap it up in a variety of different ways, and sadly we're going to have to bring it to a close, and I'm hoping maybe, Wayne, we can do a part two at some point down the road, I think this one could go on indefinitely. You say on your site, patriotism, quote, is a very powerful fiction.
Yeah.
Close quote. How does that help me get closer to some kind of, or how does a better understanding of that get me closer to a more meaningful social justice with respect
Perfect.
To, yeah.
Perfect. Absolutely. I'm 100% following you. Right. So I guess the starting point is to have a very critical self-reflection on the history of this country. And I say that as somebody who is Canadian as well. I'm not saying that as an outsider. I think that, so I'll just speak for myself then. And then you can come to your own conclusion. I think that for me, what patriotism as a powerful fiction means is that I have a responsibility to check my love. I think perhaps one of the most profound philosophical sentences I've ever read was from Hegel in The Phenomenology of Spirit, where he says that, quote, unintelligent love may perhaps do more harm than hatred, end quote. And I think that couldn't be truer. I think that when you step into this world, to unconditionally love something and unintelligently love something such as our country, I think there could be no bigger ethical mistake, because this is a country that has wrought violence upon peoples for centuries and will continue to do so until we all take a critical self-reflection about what this country means and why we unintelligently love it. And it's important to realize that we can retain our identity. We can be who we want to be. We can make a better world, but we must do so intelligently, and we must be critical of our patriotism to do that.
I love that in your film and in your mind this and in your I would imagine your writing and your thinking this leads us to love.
Yes, absolutely. That's where we end. You know, I want nothing more than these characters to find their love and for us to love them. Absolutely. Maybe that's the point. Maybe this love is something that should be transferred away from the settler state onto one another.
Wow, I think that's a pretty nice ending. I mean, it's just, from my perspective, it's just the beginning of our conversation, frankly, Wayne. But again, thanks a bundle for your time. Congratulations. How are you feeling about the world premiere on September the 12th?
I'm scared shitless.
more about the reaction to the film, or more about the Q&A, or just the madness of the festival?
Oh, it's the madness. It's a culmination of things. It's one of my mentors, Gary Harvey, who's an EP on the movie, said to me, it's always a live performance. And I don't think it could be more true.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I want to thank you for bringing me on. I think this has been, you know, a wonderful experience, and it's been a great conversation. I'd be happy to talk more in the future.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that. And I do hope that we can at least get a face-to-face at the festival. I'm going to be there for 4 or 5 days. I'm hoping maybe we can at least say hello.
Yeah, that would be great. I'm looking forward to it.
So the world premiere of Lucky, September 12th, 7:15 at the TIFF Lightbox. We've been talking with Wayne Wapemakwa here today with us. Thanks again, Wayne. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.